Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, salam, and welcome to the podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel with the New Books Network. This is your host, Shahnaz Saqani. Today, we're in an exciting conversation with Simonetta Calderani about her new book, one that I have been waiting for a very long time, Women as Imams, Classical Islamic Sources and Modern Debates on Leading Prayer, published in 2021 with IB Torres. Simonetta Calderani is Reader in Islamic Studies at the University of Roehampton in London. She has been postdoctoral research fellow at the Oriental Institute at the University of Naples in Italy, and she's a co-author of a groundbreaking book on women in pre-modern Islam called Women and the Fatimids in the World of Islam, published in 2006 with Edinburgh. Women as Imams offers an excellent overview of the debate, apparently controversial today, on women's leadership of prayer in Islam. Among the questions that it explores are, what does Islam say about women's leadership of prayer, and what do we mean by Islam here? What sources have Muslim scholars used historically to answer this question, and what do those sources say exactly? And also, in some cases, what changes have those sources undergone? What are the conditions under which women can lead prayers, if at all, and what types of prayers can they lead? Do Sunnis and Shiites differ on the matter, and perhaps why? How do contemporary Muslims respond to and deal with this question? For Calderani, contemporary discussions of women-led prayers reveal a lot about Islam generally, including questions of religious authority, conceptions of tradition in the past, and so on. But it especially brings to light the role that the past plays in contemporary Muslim attitudes about the ways that the normative past is imagined, even when textual scriptural evidence is contrary to the dominant or mainstream attitude. Throughout this discussion, the author also highlights the discrepancy between scriptural evidence and social mores, the latter of which, especially in this case, has in the question of female-led prayers, has been instrumental to our understanding of women-led prayers. In today's conversation, Calderani walks us through the many possible answers to the question, can women lead prayers in Islam? These answers range, as with pretty much all other topics in Islam, from yes, women can lead all kinds of prayers unconditionally, to no, they absolutely cannot lead anyone in prayer, like ever. We discuss the ways that female prayer leadership is connected to broader issues, such as religious authority and an imagined past or consensus. We also talk about some of the Muslim women who have, both historically and in more recent times, led prayers, as well as scholars and other authoritative figures who endorse female-led prayers. Before I give away any more of this discussion, here is my interview with Simonetta. Hi, Simonetta. Thank you so, so much for joining me today to talk about your wonderful book, Women as Imams, Classical Islamic Sources and Modern Debates on Leading Prayer. I loved it. I'm so excited that it's out. I could not wait to read it. It's also very, very famous in a Facebook group or something that I founded called Feminist Islamic Troublemakers of North America. And okay. Everybody's talking about it and everybody's raving about it. So thank you so much for writing this, finally.
Well, I'm very pleased. Thank you, Shehnaz. It's a pleasure to have been invited and to be here.
Absolutely. So it's our tradition on this podcast to ask our authors to tell us about themselves and their intellectual journey. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, sure. I've been teaching Islamic studies and religious studies for several years at the University of Roehampton, London, UK. My intellectual journey towards the study of Islam is the result of educational, but also cultural, spiritual, and historical context. And as you can hear from my slight accent, I'm Italian, and it is here that I lived through the exciting 1970s, with plenty of youth movements, some spiritual, esoteric, others political, at a time of important economic and political events linked to the Middle East and North Africa. Probably, Shehnaz, you were not even alive then. I lived in a university city where several Arab, Iranian, and other international students were attending courses, and they were politically and culturally active. So being a natural curious person in that otherwise quite sheltered city, I set out to learn about the variety of cultures, of religions, among which, of course, Islam in its great richness and diversity. And later on, I moved to the famed University L'Orientale in the glorious but totally crazy Italian city that is Naples. I studied classical Arabic, I studied Farsi, as well as Middle Eastern and Islamic history, theology and philosophy, kalam, falsafa. After Egypt and Tunisia, my studies took me to London, UK, where I did a PhD. I completed a PhD in Islamic studies with a dissertation about Islamic Ismaili cosmology, Neoplatonism and religious authority. And the issue of religious authority and leadership, the complexity, the ways in which it is validated has remained a constant interest throughout my research. And of course, in the present book, Women as Imams. As for Islam and gender, I have been among the first in the UK to teach it as a topic in its own right at university level at Roehampton. And I co-wrote the first ever monographic book on the social history of women during the Fatimid dynasty. It was a response to a kind of challenge, and I do respond to challenges, to the skepticism of scholarly establishment to believe that I would not find enough material even to write a chapter. And the result was the book Women and the Fatimids in the World of Islam. I think that's all about me for the time being.
Well, speaking of challenges and responding to challenges, I think this is an excellent, excellent response to the kind of challenge that, you know, the practice of female-led prayers get. So speaking of which, then how did the book come about and why now?
Yes, the book Women as Imams is indeed a challenge. It was indeed a challenge. It was a response to what I think was a much needed informed balance in the quite one-sided debates on female ritual leadership in Islam over the last 15 years, 17, 18 years. You can actually read the actual event that triggered the idea of the book because I outline it in the prologue to the book itself. It's just one page in the book. So what makes the book different is that I think what is its contribution? It's the first comprehensive monograph on the question of whether a Muslim woman can lead prayer. It is comprehensive in its coverage of the various Islamic legal schools and scholarly opinions. So I included Sunni, Shi'i, both Twelver and Seveners, Sufi opinions and scholars. It is comprehensive also regarding the time span the book covers, bridging the present and the past from the 7th century to the 21st. And the book is also inclusive because it features opinions about women leading prayer, women acting as imams, but also particularly in the second part, which is covering the present, it features the voices, the opinions, the interpretations of female leadership by the women imams themselves, from the better known scholars such as Amina Wadud to the imams of the Women's Mosque of America of Los Angeles, like Edina Lekovic, or the Inclusive Mosque Initiative in London, or the words of a Chinese female imam, like, for example, Du Aho, Finally, the book is different in that it is multidisciplinary and multifaceted. So I use different types of approaches from historical, theological, textual, linguistic, sociological, and discourse analysis as well. It is not only a book, therefore, on legal theological opinions, but it also discusses the way in which and the reasons why legal scholars and scholars in general engaged in such a debate. The discourse behind it, so puts their opinions into historical, legal, and theological, but also social, cultural context. I don't know if I covered about the contribution enough, or should I say more about?
That's excellent. Which that actually maybe related to the next question I was going to ask you, which is on the main arguments that are raised in the book. How does the book? Yes.
Yes. I mean that's a big big one. What I can say is that the book is as you read it is multi-layered and rich. It is exhaustive, therefore it includes many arguments. It analyzes critically different sources and approaches. And one of the main points, I think, or the main achievements, according to some of the reviews and readers' comments, is that it challenges long-held assumptions, such as, for example, that on the claim the unanimous legal consensus among Muslim legal scholars against the legitimacy of female imama. The book includes sufficient examples to contradict such a claim, and maybe we can talk about it a little bit later. But definitely the book shows that there is, and there has never been, a unanimous consensus about the issue of female leadership prayer. So main arguments, well, when it comes to the main sources that I use, among them obviously is hadith, but also fiqh works. Well, when it comes to hadith, the book obviously explores the authenticity, but above all the selective use that scholars made of these hadiths. And the different versions of hadith. And I do this by analyzing both the isnad, the chain of transmitters, and the matn, the content. And of course, I also analyze the context in which those hadiths were collected, reported, and used. One of the main arguments is that the book gives evidence that these narratives have a life and a use far beyond issues of authenticity and the reliability of their transmitters, meaning weak hadiths still have legal efficacy. They are still used in legal discourse. And this we might probably encounter some of them later on. About the foundations, I think, the book analyzes the hadiths, the several hadiths, which narrate about the prophet's wives and his female companions, who are reported as leading prayer, leading other people in prayer. Among them is the one on the female companion Umm Warata, died around 640, whom, according to a number of collectors and scholars, for example, Ibn Sa'd, but also Abu Dawud, whom the prophet ordered Amara to lead the people, Ahl, of her household in prayer. Over time, and that is one argument, over time, in different versions of those hadiths, as for example, in 10th century Ad-Darqutni, that order, the prophet ordered her to lead, becomes a permission. The people of her household become the women of her household, until in later versions, the mention of Umm Waraka's prayer and prayer leadership disappears altogether. So there are changes in matn, and in the selection of the Hadith version, which is most fitting to support a specific scholarly stance on the topic. And the analysis of these changes opens up the understanding and use of the text, not only in theological and legal context, but also historical and geographical setting, and gives an insight into the social understanding of gender hierarchy by reflecting an increased conservatism in the debate on ritual leadership. And of course, different tools were used to justify this increased conservatism. But maybe we can look at that in more details later on.
You know, when I was doing my research on female-led prayer for my dissertation, because it was one of the questions that I explored in my dissertation research as well, and I came across your study. I think you'd written an article or had given a talk, because I'm so grateful for all of your work on female-led prayers. One thing that also struck me, and you discuss it in this book as well, is the word dar, and how in this hadith, in the hadith on Waraqa, it's both, you know, whether the Prophet ordered her, that language changes over time in this hadith. So the text of the hadith is changing with time in accordance with social customs and such. But also the word dar, and that was so striking to me and such a betrayal. It's infuriating, right? But I mean, I have a lot to say on female-led prayer, because as you can tell. But so tell us then, what are some of the positions regarding woman-led prayers? Because it's like you said, there's no unanimity on any one position. So there is, and you address, and this is one thing that one of the things that I loved about your book, as you mentioned earlier as well, you're dealing with Sunni and Sufi and Shi'i. You're not just dealing with one particular sect. Or group of Muslims' opinions, and you are looking at historical and also contemporary, and it's just so brilliantly done. Thank you so much for it. So what are some of the positions regarding woman-led prayers in Muslim history, historically, and maybe contemporary as well?
Okay, well, Shehnaz, thank you so much for all the praise. I'm glad that, this was of benefit to scholars. And yes, the issue of Dar, as you know, I suggest, obviously, there are a number of interpretations, and Dar means many things, not only home, not only house, but, it could be broader, and it could even mean more than that. It could be tribe or group. So your question on the positions about the female imam, well, as you said, there is complexity, nuance, and variety. So I'm a little bit hesitant to put it in a short, concise manner, because I don't want to risk simplification when there is so much variety and there are so many shades of opinions within legal schools. And even, within an individual scholar, can obviously change slightly his or her opinions. So let's try and do it in a nutshell for our listeners to sure. make it possible. Okay, so in a nutshell, prohibition. A Muslim woman cannot lead men nor women in prayer. Nuances a lot. Where is the prayer taking place? Which type of prayer? Who is among the congregation? Where is it? Is it in a mosque, in a house, etc.? But anyway, a Muslim woman cannot lead men nor women in prayer. The Malikis, now I think the second largest madhab, support prohibition, full prohibition of leadership, whether the congregation is male or female. On which basis? Well, according to, for example, Al-Baji, 11th century, is as a result of the female lack of perfection, meaning the imam is the guide, the leader of the congregation. Therefore, has to be an exemplar, the best of the congregation, closest to the prophet, to a leader in his perfection. And according to Baji, women are not perfect. They have two main deficiencies. And of course, he uses apt hadith to support that. And the two main deficiencies are deficiency in religion, deen, and in intellect. This is what Al-Baji says. Deficiency in religion, we are used to that in terms of, for example, you know, to do with the issue of purity. When a woman menstruates or when she has just given birth, she's considered to be impure to approach prayers, so let alone lead the prayer. So this is one of the justifications. A little bit deeper, if we go a little bit deeper, there is a methodological reason, which is the fact that the Malikis rely on what they called as the practice of Medina, what they believe to be the orally transmitted practice of Medina. So, prohibition, Malikis. You may ask, how about the practice in Medina that we mentioned earlier on the basis of the Hadith on Umm Waraka and others? Well, the Hanafis, which is the largest, at present, the largest madhab, I believe, in the Muslim world, shifted their position from a variety of opinions at the beginning to that of permission for women only. For a women-only congregation. That is, a woman can lead in prayer, but only other women. This is what Shaibani, for example, stated in the 9th century. But over time, there is a development whereby scholars believe that it is better for a woman, in fact, to pray on her own, not in group. Therefore, there is no need for a woman to lead prayer. Until we come to the 11th, 12th century, when there is this use of the theory of abrogation, whereby female leadership of prayer had been abrogated. Now, if you look more closely at the sources, they don't tell you when this happened, they don't tell you who abrogated it, and even what was abrogated. Was the practice that was abrogated, or the desirability of the leadership? So it is unclear. If you add to this another development, that of the concept of fitna, which applied to a woman has to do with temptation, then you have the, you know, general position of permission for women only congregation, but even better not. So it is theoretically and legally still valid, that kind of leadership, but it is not desirable. When it comes to the Shafi madhab, they argue that they base their arguments on textual evidence, on hadith. And this is quite interesting. I was very excited when I was reading the Kitab al-Umm by Ash-Shafi, the eponym of the school, because he doesn't mention Salama, Aisha, and the Jariya of Ali ibn al-Hussein as examples and precedents of women leading other women in prayer. And the argument of Ash-Shafi goes, look, the important thing is that because the prayer is a legal obligation, that obligation has to be fulfilled. Even if the leader is not the ideal leader, who, of course, you know, according to the times, would have been the male leader, it is better for that obligation to be fulfilled rather than wait for the ideal leader. So this is for the Shafi, who eventually limited the female leadership to leadership at home rather than in a mosque or in another context. Hanbali, this is the more recent school. At first, it was legally permissible for a woman to lead women, even desirable, according to Ibn Qudama, for example. No abrogation there, but times have changed. This is the Fasad al-Zaman. They have become corrupted and they deteriorated. So really better not. However, you know, look at a scholar like Ibn Taymiyyah, 14th century, for whom female leadership of prayer of women is legitimate, even desirable. So you see, there is variation. Shia, both 12er and the seveners, female leadership of other women is legitimate if the woman leads not from the front, but from the middle. Different reasons for it, but this is the, you know, the overarching type of argument. And in the book, I refer to a 2000 fatwa by the then president of Iran, Mohammad Khatami, stating and reaffirming the permission for women to lead other women in prayer in Friday prayer. So I leave you to read the book to see what kind of context and provisos are included there. And one thing is, let's remember the theory and the practice. This is something that when we look at legal discourses and legal opinions, I repeat over and over in the book, because you might have a theoretical permission of women leading other women in prayer, the practice might be quite different. So far I talked about mainly prohibition, permission for women to lead other women in prayer. How about leading men? Well, for the pre-modern times, it would be best, more accurate, rather than talking about the permission of women leading mixed congregations, the focus was on the validity of prayer, the validity of prayer of a man who is led by a woman. So is his prayer still valid? This is how they put it in legal terms in pre-modern times. A very interesting position is that of the Sufi, the mystic, polymath, etc., Ibn Arabi, 13th century. I devoted a whole section in the book to the quite complex statements in his Futuhat. And basically, Ibn Arabi argues that spiritual leadership is given by God, irrespective of gender, of the gender of the recipient, of its recipient. But as I argue in the book, there is still obviously a hierarchical understanding, both in theory and possibly in practice in Ibn Arabi. But this is a fantastic section, which I really enjoyed covering. So in terms of legal scholars who were not against the the leadership of a woman leading in prayer men, they in pre-modern times they justify their position by applying the concept of preeminence of companions and the methods of the Ahl al-Hadith, that is the precedent found in the Hadith at the time of the Prophet. Precedent like Waraka. The scholars who are not against a woman leading men in prayer include 9th century Abu Thawr al-Baghdadi, al-Muzani, Dawud al-Zahiri, or the more famous 10th century at-Tabari, Muhammad ibn Jarir at-Tabari, the author of the Tafsir, but also the Tariq. You also asked about the present. Very quickly, the arguments in favor of female imams of men or of a mixed congregation. Well, a number of examples that I mentioned in the book, the female imams themselves, of course, Amina Wadud, but also USA-based Natia Jackson, Pamela Taylor. I also mention the work of the Danish imam Sherin Kam Khan, or words and arguments of UK-based imams such as Asma Ball, for example. Among the male supporters, there are scholars like Abdennur Pardo, the chair of International Congress of Islamic Feminism, with some provisos, Khaled Abul Fadl, he issued a fatwa in 2010 about the permissibility of of a woman leading men in prayer on condition that men are not behind her, but on her side. And others such as, you know, the Grand Mufti of Marseille, Sohaib Ben Sheikh. My favorite, I really enjoyed going to the British Library to read his book, is the Egyptian intellectual and unionist and activist Jamal al-Banna. He died in 2013. Yes, al-Banna of the same family, in fact, is the younger brother of Hassan, the founder of the Ikhwan al-Muslimin. Jamal al-Banna wrote in Arabic a book of endorsement of female imam of men only a few months after Amina Wadud's 2005 New York prayer leadership. In the book, which I paraphrase from Arabic, some of the main arguments in my book, he argues that all the negative reactions to Amina's leadership mask the fact that the main issue at stake is not prayer leadership, but, as he put it, that of woman, specifically the assumed inferiority of woman based on what Jamal al-Banna believes to be a patriarchal misreading of the Quranic passages and message. So, sorry, the nutshell has become a little bit of a tree, maybe a bonsai, but I hope I have answered the most of the question about the positions of the legal schools.
You know, that was an excellent summary of the very, very different positions in both history and in contemporary time. So thank you. No, that was wonderful. My favorite is when the legal schools or the individuals who don't support it, and then they'll find a hadith, you know, like the ones that you talk about in the book, and they'll have the hadith right in front of them, but they'll still say, well, I know the hadith says, you know, women can lead women in prayer at the very least, but I still prefer, or I dislike women leading prayer. I love how much esteem you give yourself, like how much importance you give yourself and your opinions. I guess they knew their opinions would basically become, you know, would essentially ultimately become attributed to God. So they had a point. But so this comes up in our discussion in a lot of your answers so far. But what does the discussion or the history of this discussion and this debate on female-led prayer tell us about other issues in Islam? What other issues are at stake here?
Quite a number of them. Obviously, the issue of female religious authority itself, how female authority is achieved, how it is validated, how it is acknowledged, by whom, and how it is exercised. And there are evolving meanings and understandings of what a female religious authority or religious authority as a whole actually are. Especially in the second part of the book that covers modern cases of female imams in different continents, those cases of female imams become illustrations of a number of answers to these questions, answers which reflect different expressions of authority, or different types of women's agency in different cultures, circumstances, and different times. So I give examples of women imams in the Maldives, for example, the Mudahim, in the women's mosques, which unfortunately have been closed over the last years, and you know there are references to them being opened in 1970s with the state sponsorship. Then I give examples of women imams in the women's mosques of central China. And I give examples of one example from Somalia, 1960s, 70s, roughly, of Injabi Day. Other issues, the recurrent motif of the book is, which I think is paramount as a means of legitimizing authority and leadership, is the use of tradition and the reappropriation of the past. This is broader than just the issue of continuity and rupture, but it is also about how the past is constructed and how it is deployed, used in different ways. The book argues that the past is not fixed. It is a changing, evolving discourse, Assad, Talal Assad put it, the anthropologist put it, it is a discursive tradition, which references the past, embodied in the present, and is projected to hopefully shape the future. To sum up, while some of the classical arguments against the female imam are still used today, you know, the weak hadith are still used, the abrogation, the fact that the practice is legitimate only for the women of the Prophet's time and is not applicable to today, etc., etc., other arguments reflect the modern contemporary context and discourse, especially the political understanding and discourse of fitna and dissent, which the opponents of female leadership of prayer believe will result in the disunity of the ummah, in some cases linking it to conspiracy theories of the West versus Islam. So one important shift in the debates in the debate is the development of the role of the imam, herself or himself, especially in Muslim minority countries, where the imam is not only a prayer leader, but also a counselor, a legal guide, a chaplain, a community spokesman for the media. And Shehnaz, there are many more arguments and issues in this book. And I hope that the attentive reader will uncover them, ponder and think about it, and hopefully gain from them.
And you do the book, I think it's near the end, it does an excellent job discussing this use, how the past is being used and unused and revised, you know, to fit particular ideas. And other scholars who've written on female-led prayers have also pointed out that ultimately what's happening is, you know, you first make the conclusion and then you find the evidence. And if one of those pieces of evidence happens to be, well, this is the conclusion, if the conclusion is that no, women cannot lead prayer, then you'll find all kinds of evidence or arguments to support that. But I really enjoyed your discussion on the use of the past, and that is a part of your argument in the book is very excellently done. And of course, what it's doing to tradition and how traditions are being formed and reformed. One of the reasons why I love talking about female-led prayer, because it tells us so much about more than just female-led prayers or prayer leadership or ritual authority and so on. It does a lot more than that as well. So thank you. Is there anything else that you would like to talk about before we come to a close?
Maybe on another occasion, there is a lot. I mean, earlier on when we were having our private conversation and exchanges, you mentioned about some of the figures I introduce in the book, and one who is less famous than others. Of course, we know about Aisha, we know about Salama, we know about Waraka, but you were quite impressed with Ghazala, I think.
Ghazala, she was so fascinating to read about. I had never heard about her, and I love having a list of these women as, you know, as historical evidence of we can do this, or other women have done it too. Yes.
Well, Ghazala, she's a great character. I mean, whether it is a kind of literary figure or, you know, how far it is actually historically accurate, that's a question. But the sources for who talked about Ghazala are historical, and some of them are heresiographies against the Kharijis. She's the wife of a Khariji leader. So that's really, probably a book in itself, because it opens up the issue of the Imama al-Kubra and Imama al-Sughra, the leadership of the political and military leadership and the prayer leadership. And it's interesting that it's not only about Ghazala, who was obviously, you know, within issues of Khariji rebellions, etc., etc., but in fact is a link that I established also in the discussion about Waraka and Salama, because there is a link between their status, their support and zeal for the Prophet and for the Islam, you know, the cause of Islam, their participation or their will to participate in war, and their leadership of prayer. So that's a whole a new avenue, a new trajectory that I'd love to address maybe in the next life. I don't know.
No, that was the other interesting theme that I think appears in the question of women-led prayer, is like how sort of how historically and politically grounded these opinions are, the way that, you know, Ghazala is remembered or talked about or portrayed compared to Salama or Aisha or Waraka. And also one thing that I found fascinating, and we'll have to talk about it at a different point, but the Shia response to female-led prayer, I don't think it's possible. And you just talked about the nuances of the different positions, but what was so interesting to me is that Shiites appear to be a lot more open to letting women lead prayer than Sunnis, I think, are. But that response is rooted in politics. It's rooted in their status and identity as Shiites, as minoritized minority figures in history and so on. So it's, I mean, such a rich subject and such a wonderful book. I'm so glad that this exists. Thank you again I keep thanking you, but I've been looking for something like this for so long and it's finally out. So I'm really grateful. And as we come to a close, we like to ask our authors if they can tell us about any new or any current projects, research projects that they're working on that they're willing to share with us, that we can look forward to in the near future.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for thanking me. Thank you. I have two, three projects that I'm currently working on or supposed to work on. One is more relevant to the main topic of this book and our conversation, and it is to look at the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on female leadership of prayer and Friday prayer performance. As I was finishing my book on women as imams, the first lockdown came in force in the UK because of the restrictions, and not without controversy, of course. Some Friday prayers started to be delivered online in different ways, including via Zoom, for example. And the virtual environment of an online Friday prayer during a pandemic raises the question of the extent to which gender hierarchies and roles are still maintained or lifted in cyberspace. And one of the research questions I ask is this: is the easing of gender restrictions due to special circumstances, or can it be applied to the expanding online presence of religious female preachers, leaders, and female prayer performance? ? Shehnaz, are you still there?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Oh,
I'm
sorry. That was my project, one of my projects.
Okay, I wasn't sure if you were going to continue, if there was a glitch or something. So that sounds really exciting. And it is so true that with the pandemic, I too got invitations to lead prayers and to give khutbahs, and that has never happened before. And I was like, whoa. So it definitely changed something. Oh, that's exciting. That's an exciting and relevant project. Thank you for working on that too. So that is all that I have for us today. I'm so glad this conversation happened, and I cannot wait to share this around with people and cannot wait to gift people this book of yours, people always ask for, you know, references and resources on this question, especially when they're honest enough to know that they don't know enough about it before they can give an opinion on it. And it's really such a relevant topic and such an important topic. And I'm happy that finally another resource exists that we can that helps us better understand the subject. So thank you.
Thank you, Shehnaz, for hosting this this event, and thank you for asking the questions, and thank you for thanking me, and and for being so so positive about the contribution of my book. Thank you, Shehnaz.
Absolutely. All right. So that was our conversation with Simonetta Calderani on her new book, Women as Imams: Classical Islamic Sources and Modern Debates on Leading Prayer, published in 2021 with I.B. Torres. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you again soon. Khuda pamand.